It's Monday, October 3rd, 2011. Philosophy 201 Ethics. So today we're doing a little bit of catch-up. We're going to be talking about a little bit about moral relativism and moving right on to skepticism. So last time I had you fill out a little piece of paper. I'm still leafing through those about whether morality is relative or not. And we're going to talk about that today, and then I'll give you those papers back on Wednesday. Then we're going to move on to talking about the problem of skepticism. So just to begin with one announcement as far as course mechanics. So there was a deadline that passed last night at 11:55 p.m. It was a deadline to post to the week one forum. If you were late out or something like that, getting your book late, no book yet, problems like that, you'd send me a Moodle message this first week only, and I may have pity on your soul. For the rest of them, either you remember or you don't, you either do it or you don't, you get credit by posting by the deadline or you don't. A couple of people, I sent them brief messages saying, hey, you only posted 77 words, that's not enough, the question doesn't count as part of the word count. So just make sure you have at least 100 words there. Do not copy the question into your answer. And I probably should have said this last Wednesday, but just from now on, you should know, do not copy the question into your answer. All of you, I hope, got direction on this. When you are answering an essay question, you incorporate the question into your answer. So if you get the question, what is the capital of Assyria? You say the capital of Assyria is Nineveh, right? So that way people understand what question you're answering. You don't paste the question in, because then you get the question, the same question, pasted a million times. So just, you know, answer the question and just make it clear which question you're answering. And again, you can pose your own question. You can respond to another student. You don't have to answer those questions at the top, but those are you can answer any of those. Also, I'll probably post in each of the prompts, I'll have three or four questions. You don't have to answer every question. And probably if you're only posting, you know, 100, 200, 300 words, you can't address all the questions adequately. So, you know, pick one or maybe two if the second one's related, and do that. And make sure you post by 11:55 p.m. Sunday night. You're also expected to read all the posts, and I'll have some more comments there the first week scramble. I haven't had a chance to mark all the posts yet. I usually get on there Sunday night and do a lot of them and try to get in there earlier in the week, but you know, you wouldn't believe what my email looks like with people adding, dropping, trying to figure out Moodle. And so anyway, I'll be interacting with you online as well. Have any trouble, send me a Moodle message, and let's see if we get things ironed out. Okay, on to relativism. So last time we were talking about the fact that different cultures seem to have different customs, and some of the customs seem strange, disgusting, morally reprehensible, inhuman, but to the people in those cultures, they seem normal, natural, honorable. And so the question is, what do we make of this fact? So there's this, so different cultures. Different cultures have different moral beliefs and practices. This is just a fact, right? Anybody want to dispute this fact? Now that, have I poisoned the well by saying this is a fact? Anyone want to dispute this fact? Well, yeah, is this a fact?
Yeah.
We talked about some examples last time, right? We talked about people over in the Middle East sawing off the clitorises of little girls.
right? We talked about Ina, the one to take her top off on the rafting trip, and because she's from Norway. When you're on vacation and you're not in the frigid ice and snow, and you're in the warmth of the Riviera or some tropical island, you want to get a full suntan. And we talked about the fact that maybe in a Middle Eastern country, it's considered lewd to have exposed elbows and ankles, and you have women that are dressed head to toe in a full burqa, or you might have a woman wearing a veil where just her eyes are showing. And so you have these different standards of modesty, how much of your body can show. Of course, typically these modesty taboos have to do with women. Men can pretty much wear what they want. And then if you look at areas like Africa, you have people running around with like a loincloth on in the places where it gets really hot. And then you have sort of these extreme examples, like in India, where I talked about the custom called sute, where the woman is expected to leap on her husband's funeral pyre as he's being cremated, because I would say the underlying misogynist belief there is, what good is a woman without a man, right? And if she chooses not to do that, she would be dishonored, and she would have two choices. She could either be a beggar or a prostitute, or maybe some combo of two, I guess. And I look at that, and I think that's a pretty horrific cultural practice. And I might even go out on a limb and say that that's morally wrong to treat treat a woman like that, to treat anybody like that. But the cultural relativists can't say that, because to a relativist, morality just boils down to whatever the majority in your society believe or practice. And so as long as you get 50% plus one, it's right. If that one person changes his mind, or that 1% changes their mind, it goes from being right to wrong overnight. Usually these changes happen gradually, but as long as you have the majority with you, then you're A-okay, according to relativism. Now, so this is not cultural relativism in and of itself. All this says is that different cultures have different cultural rules. Relativism says those moral beliefs and practices are right for those cultures. Not for others, other cultures, who don't share them. So again, you need 50% plus one equals it's right or wrong. Depending what it is, right? So you could put this in terms of some positive belief, or you could say, murder is wrong. If 50% plus one say murder is wrong, then murder is wrong. If 50% plus one say that it's right to eat dead animal flesh, to kill animals for food, then it's right. And so, To be a cultural relativist, morality is pretty easy, right? All you have to do is take a poll. Mr. Gallup is a moral philosopher, according to relativism. He asked Americans what they think about abortion or doctor-assisted suicide or pornography or what have you, adultery or driving an SUV or working for a tobacco company or whatever it is, right? Voting for a Republican, right? So you go down like the list of things, and if you just look at the polls and what do people say? And so if you get the majority to say, yeah, that's the right thing to do, or no, that's the wrong thing to do, that's what it is.
Yeah.
What about for cultures that aren't like democratic, where, you know, whoever's making these laws doesn't take the 50% plus one into effect? You know, it's hard to think of an example, but, you know, if they don't account for what the people under them think about or care, is it still, you know, 50% plus one makes it right or wrong, or is it that one person deciding and making it right or wrong?
So there's a difference between moral and legal.
So it would still be right or wrong depending on what the majority said, but that might not always match up with the law.
Okay.
What's a good example of a case where the populace has one moral belief, but the government has a different law? Yeah.
Southern lawmakers in pre-Civil War times who would, you know, legalize slavery, even though the majority of the population were slaves or Negroes.
Yeah, so if you had, like, so that's a good example. So if you had the majority in a certain area are slaves, so obviously they're the majority, they'd rather be free, but the law keeps them as slaves, right? Now, you raised an interesting point there. What about, like, when you're trying to decide what this culture counts as, how big do you go and how small do you go, right? Is the South a culture? I mean, people say there's like Southern culture, right? Or you just go with like American culture. If you count up all the Americans, maybe you get a majority of people in favor of slavery. And so that's one of the problems. Well, yeah, was there another example of that? Oh, Patrick.
Maybe like Iran and the Ayatollah?
Yeah, they're... I think that Iran is a sort of a modern country, and there are a lot of young people, and most young people don't want Islamic rule over the country, at least not the hardline Islamic rule of the fundamentalist clerics, although it's kind of like in America where you get a lot of sort of middle Americans say, you know, they want the Bible to be the law of the land, or they want rules about, you know, laws passed about public morality still, even young people. But you know, they don't want like a cleric, like, you know, deciding who does what in every aspect of their life. So that might be a good example. So now we'll come to Thomas Hobbes, and Hobbes actually says what's moral is what's legal, which is a kind of interesting point of view. The view is called legal positivism, where it's legal positivism. But in ordinary, you know, ordinary people who, you know, aren't Hobbes, they'll say, look, there can be an immoral law, right? You can have a law that says, turn in any Jews you may see on the street, no hiding Jews in your basement, send them off to the death camps, be gassed. There may be a law that says, blacks have to ride in the back of the bus. There may be a law that says women can't vote, right? So in the you can think of historical examples of immoral laws. There were laws that said that you can't have interracial marriage. That's, by the way, one of the reasons for marriage licenses. The concept of marriage license is a fairly recent innovation. So the clerk would like record marriages and, you know, for legal purposes. But the idea you need a permission slip for the government to get married was intended to keep people from marrying people of different races. Okay, what are maybe some arguments in favor of relativism? Can you think of any? Yeah.
It allows people to do whatever they want.
Ooh, is that really true, though? Does relativism allow people to do whatever they want?
Well, yeah. Thoughts? I'll give you an example. you remember after Rodney King riots?
You're going to have to speak up, sir. You're over the car.
Rodney King
riots. Yes.
Verdict, the riots. Remember Reginald Denny, a truck driver, they got pulled out?
Mm-hmm.
The guy with the brick was doing exactly what he wanted to do, with no moral constraints. He was self-actualized. So he got to do what he wanted to do. He just didn't care or buy into any of the constraints or norms that everybody else said were there. He was fully self-actualized. You get to do what you want to do.
I'm not sure what self-actualized means. That
Maslow's hierarchy, that's his highest thing.
Do you really know that's true about him?
I'm just going by his behavior.
Yeah, I'm not sure his behavior gives you a window of his soul, but let's leave the Maslow's hierarchy stuff aside. Okay. So you're saying that relativism would say that what he did was okay, because why?
Because he wanted to do it, and that's the highest standard for relativism, what I want to do.
Is that, you know, you're talking about individual relativism, not cultural relativism, right? Like the.
I'm talking about.
Like subjective. So let me ask this question: like, how might subjectivism or individual relativism differ in this case from cultural relativism? So you have during the riots over the verdicts in the Rodney King criminal case, where you had a bunch of white police officers who beat a black motorist at a traffic stop, caught on video, and the police were acquitted of charges of police brutality, the overzealous use of force, or whatever the term is, right? So, and they were acquitted, and you had massive riots in the city of Los Angeles, primarily from angry African Americans, and you had this guy, a white truck driver, going through an intersection. He couldn't go because there was traffic was blocked, and a guy named Antoine Miller, I think was his name, came up, pulled him out of his truck, slammed the fire extinguisher on his back, and then hit him over the head with a brick, giving him lifelong injuries and disabilities. So then the question is, what would moral relativism say about his actions? Any thoughts? Yeah.
According to most of our culture's moral beliefs, that would be considered wrong. Murder.
Yeah, if you go on the cultural relativist point of view, and you say, let's say the culture is American culture, so that one could be considered wrong. Because you can't, just because you're angry at some legal thing, most people consider rioting to be wrong. They consider beating an innocent person because you're angry to be wrong. And also, I mean, they consider racism to be wrong. And racism is not just like a white on black thing, right? It can be a black and white thing, right? So this guy singled out Reginald Denny because he was angry and because he represented to him like the white police officer. And it's like all those white people who are down on the black people, and so I'm gonna get my revenge and support my group. And so most people think that rioting, violence against innocent people and racism are wrong. So from a cultural relativist point of view, it would be wrong. What about from like an individual relativist or a subjectivist point of view? Yeah.
From an individualistic
point of view. So just say subjectivism.
Yeah, okay, so from a subjectivist point of view, they would be looking at him and saying, well, what happened in his past? What were his motivations for making that decision? And does that justify, in his mind and with his own personal history, were his actions moral at that moment in time?
Well, I think that's
what subjectivism means.
So that's a little different than the subjectivist view. You're thinking about it from more of a kind of an absolutist point of view. You're thinking, okay, he did this bad thing, and everyone agrees it's bad, but maybe there's some mitigating circumstances where it's not maybe as bad, or maybe there are some reasons which might excuse his behavior. But you're still thinking in absolutist or universalist terms. You're thinking what he did was wrong, but maybe he doesn't deserve all the blame that we want to heap on him. So the subjectivist viewpoint says that it's all coming from him and his moral code. What is Antoine Miller's moral code? If his moral code is get whitey, or support the race, or if it's live according to your impulses, and that's what he does, then he's okay according to his subjectivism. If, on the other hand, he, like, if he thinks racism is wrong, maybe he's engaging in something that's an example of hypocrisy. So maybe he has the moral belief racism is wrong, but he got sort of out of control, he was really angry, and did something that maybe he regretted later. And so if his moral code, on their hand, is like, get Whitey and don't get caught, maybe he regrets it just because he got caught. Or, you know, and he was kind of a gang member and had all the, kind of a shady past, too. So, but yeah, so that's an example where I think cultural relativism would say that definitely what he did was wrong. Subjectivism or the individual relativism, it would depend on what his personal moral code is. And you really don't know that until you, like, you have to, like, interrogate him and find out what it is. And I suppose that's one problem with subjectivism, is that you can never know from someone's actions whether what they did is right or wrong until you find out what their moral code is. So if I see someone, like, feeding a puppy, you know, and the puppy, and the guy's, like, got some, like, the lesions, whacking this little puppy over and over again, and I react with revulsion and maybe a little bit of anger. I'll have to go, excuse me, sir, could you tell me what's your personal moral code? I want to determine whether or not your beating this puppy is wrong or not, because I can't judge you on the basis of my moral code. My moral code says beating puppies is bad, but I don't know about your moral code is, so you can please share with me what your moral code is. Or if I see somebody, like, you know, dumping a body in the Willamette River, and I see his trunks, like, full with driver's licenses and purses and things. And, excuse me, sir, could you tell me, his body dumped in the river is it, according to your own moral code, is it okay for you to kill some women and, you know, dispose of the bodies in the Willamette River? And if he said, yes, that's what I sincerely believe, it's my right to do so, I'd just say, oh, okay. And I'd just walk off. Okay. So that's subjective. Right? So, I mean, that's a problem for subjectivism, right? If you say that it's up to each individual what's right or wrong, according to their moral code, whatever it is, without any other principles, then that's going to give you some really weird, you know, it's going to give you some outcomes which conflict with most people's moral intuitions about right and wrong. Yes?
Okay, so let's say I'm a subjectivist, and my moral code is a little warped, and I think it's good to kill people. So isn't that a little bit insane? I mean, I understand the moral code into that person, and that it can be, well, anything, really. You know, what you think in your head that's right is right to you, as a subjectivist. But I personally don't think that we can really count that as a moral if it's not in any way being able to, like, I don't think any culture really sees that would be right in killing someone unless they had a reason for it. So just killing someone, like the killing a woman and then disposing of her body, that's not really, that's
more insane,
isn't it?
It was like for the thrill. Because no one, because you can't pick up any women at the bar.
Yeah, but is that moral? Can you put that into somebody's moral code and say that that is immoral?
Well, look at, like, the Vikings. You know, they went up and down the European coast, sacking villages, raping women, burning things to the ground.
Yeah.
That was their cultural imperative. Rape, loot,
like,
and pillage.
They believe that's right. I guess I'm trying to wrap my mind around how can this even be a possible moral code for someone when it just doesn't really seem possible.
Do you think, like, you know, the... you know, Rothgar, like, sat awake at night, you know, pulling on his beard and thinking, oh, I'm such a bad person. No,
I
mean...
No, I don't think that.
So you had a whole culture of, basically, of a psychopaths. And there's lots of historical examples of this, right?
So
the Nazis is another good example.
They can still be psychotic and they can still be crazy as mofo, but they have a moral code.
So now a lot of people want to say, well, that's not, like, immoral, that's just crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is every racist crazy? Is every misogynist crazy? Is every thief crazy? Is every murderer crazy? I mean, most people, they have, like, reasons. Like, they killed their wife. Why? Because she was stepping out with, the next-door neighbor or something like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, all sorts of reasons for murder. You know, jealousy, money.
I understand that part. It's the people who have no guilt. I don't see their moral code. even as a subjectivist, if they have no guilt, it doesn't seem like they have one.
Well, what if they just feel like a little bit guilty, but not enough guilt that
they have
enough insurance payoff or something like that?
I guess
that.
They have to pass if they're a little guilty.
The other thing is, like, once you do something long and over again, like, the guilt feelings kind of melt away. Like, Ted Bundy actually talks about this. He said the first time that he killed a woman, he, like, threw up uncontrollably and, like, felt like he was going to die. But the thrill of the kill, like, kept him going back to the second one, and over time he came not just to be able to tolerate it, but to crave it and to derive immense pleasure from it.
Yeah.
And so
it felt no guilt. It felt no guilt, right?
Yeah.
Towards the end.
Yes. Sorry, a little bit loud. Not a little bit. A lot louder.
I would say the subjectivist would say that if you stumbled upon somebody dumping dead bodies in the river, and if that was their moral code, then that's a good crime. But then, if your moral code states that if I see this, I have to stop them, then you are in full rights in your moral code to stop that person from doing it.
Okay, so you're saying that if you get two subjectivists with contrary moral codes, it's okay for the one person, if his moral code says stop people from doing this thing, then he can do that, because that's his moral code. Yeah, so I guess you can have, like, moral codes can conflict, and then people can, like, duke it out or something. And they can't have any discussion, though, over, like, what actually is right in the situation. So, I mean, if you think about subjectivism, another problem with it is you really can't have moral conversations with people, because each person is their own moral island. And there's no sense in discussing moral principles, because each person has their own principles, and it's whatever they believe is right. Which is kind of weird. What about this idea that cultural relativism leads to greater tolerance? I talk about this a little bit in the book. What do you think about that? This idea that if we all just, in your example here, you're thinking, okay, well, it's my moral code says to stop it. So does that mean, like, if I'm living here in America and I see some, you know, there's, like, people in the Middle East that are, you know, doing things that I did, like treating women as second-class citizens, and they're mutilating genitals, and they're letting women drive automobiles, avoiding the women driving jokes here, potentially. So all these bad things, does that mean that it's okay for me to try to change what they're doing if I think it's wrong as a cultural relativist, or for America to, like, maybe, put pressure, economic, or maybe even send troops over to stop people from doing those things? Because if you think from an individual relativist point of view, if you can change somebody's behavior, if it goes against your moral code, on a cultural relativist point of view, wouldn't it be okay then for one culture to try to change another culture because its values, conflicted with that diverse culture? But then it seems like the whole idea behind cultural relativism goes out the window. Because the idea is that, oh, well, we shouldn't judge other cultures for what they do. What they do is appropriate for them, and what we do is appropriate for us. And let's all be friends. So what do you think? Yes, sir?
Just to answer your question, does it create more tolerance? Probably if you were on the side of the majority, there's more tolerance for the right point of view, which could be all inclusive, something for, or it could be let's kill all the people.
Yeah.
It depends upon which side is in the majority, whether there's tolerance or not.
Yeah, so it depends on, like, what the moral rules are for a society. So for tolerance, if tolerance is a value of that culture, then maybe it does create greater tolerance if you're a relativist. But on the other hand, there's lots of intolerant cultures, right? There's cultures which oppress religious minorities and women and racial minorities and so on and so forth. And they so you can have very intolerant cultures. And so the cultural relativist says, if it's an intolerant culture, as long as the majority believe in intolerance, then intolerance is perfectly okay. The other thing is that it seems that the relativist has an absolute value, namely tolerance. They say you can do anything you want except for judge another culture. And that's absolutely wrong. No matter what your culture is, you can't judge another culture. And so it doesn't really seem like they're relativists. Otherwise, they would say, well, you know, go ahead and judge another culture if that's part of your culture. So it's it's just got all kinds of problems. The other problem we talked about earlier is that how small and how big do you go? So I just spent some time in San Francisco. San Francisco, a very liberal city. You know, if you're gay, transgender, genderqueer, sort of non-standard person, maybe you got long hair, maybe you wear sandals year-round, you're going to fit right in. You know, I spent some time on the Berkeley campus, you know, lots of different kinds of people. People are really tolerant, and they have very sort of liberal social attitudes. The friend I was staying with is now in Mississippi, and now she's like in the coastal area, so it's not quite as conservative maybe as inland, but it's very very conservative, not sort of a gay friendly area. And if you're kind of if you look too weird, like if you look like a typical resident of Berkeley, you know, people are going to look at you. You might get some sneers or stares, and it's a totally different world there, right? So. Very, very religious, very conservative from a sort of moral and religious point of view. So you get these two different areas. Now, what's weird about relativism is if you're gonna, what are you gonna do? So you're gonna say, okay, well, there's like American culture. Here are the rules for 310 million people. Is that really going to work? I mean, if you take a typical person from Biloxi, Mississippi, and put them next to somebody from Berkeley, they're going to have totally different moral points of view, right? Probably religious, secular, conservative, liberal, and attitudes about sexuality, maybe about race, maybe about free market capitalism. You sort of go down the line about what the beliefs are, they're going to be very different. And so, is that really going to work, just going with like big national boundaries? And then what if like you're in San Francisco, you drive into Chinatown, right? All of a sudden everybody around you is Chinese in their first or second generation, and they all have certain views about religion which are different than the majority. They have views about culture. You know, the Asian cultures tend to be more collectivist and less individualist. Ideas like honor and family a lot more important than in America. Academic higher value of academic achievement, less interest in sports. And these are sort of generalities, but these are you know, attitudes. Yeah, this is why when you have Asian immigrants, they tend to outperform the native population. It's because of the Asian culture. Part of that is the prizing, you know, overall of education. So then what do? Are you going to like chop it up into like a Chinatown goes along with China, and then like we're going to put Berkeley together with like maybe New York City and Manhattan, but and then LA, like South Central is going to go with Berkeley and San Francisco, but Orange County, we're going to put that together with Mississippi, and it's just not going to make any sense. You're going to have some weird kind of patchwork of counties and areas where people have certain attitudes. So, and then you get subcultures, right? So you get, they're not just like the national groups, but there's ethnic and religious groups. And then you have groups like skater dudes, like people who are into sci-fi, right? And so then you get individuals that are a member of all these different groups. You have this guy, Allen Ginsberg, right? So Allen Ginsberg lived in the San Francisco area. So maybe a liberal. But he's also a Jew. Should he go along with his Jewish culture? Well, as it turns out, he's ethnically a Jew, but he's religiously is an atheist. So is there like an atheist culture? If you're an atheist, you do what all the other atheists do? And then he's a poet. Should he go along with like what poets do? Or I'm trying to think of some other attribute of Allen Ginsberg. He's a writer. Is there like a writer culture? So each of us are members of all these different groups depending on our interests and our friends and where we grew up and what our religion is, if any. And so all those things, you know, make us complex individuals. So it's not as simple as the relativist wants to make it out, where you just say, okay, where do you live? Okay, here's the rules you follow. And another question is, do you go with what people say they believe or what they practice? Can you think of an example where belief and practice might be different? Like what people really think they should do as opposed to what they actually do? Yeah.
World War II, Nazi Germany. I'm sure a lot of people didn't agree with the anti-Jewish and minority laws that were passed, but they went along with them because punishment would fall upon them and their families if they went against the government.
Yeah, so maybe it's people are afraid to speak out. Sure, that might be a reason. What about a case where you have people with a sincere belief that they should live a certain way, but then they don't actually live that way?
Polygamy?
Well, I mean, if you have people that are like held against their will or something like a polygamous cult, how about something more commonplace? Yeah.
Jimmy Swagger,
right. Let's just take sex in general, right? So you have a lot of people that believe that sex is something that's sacred, that should be held for the bonds of matrimony. But if you look at, you know, what, say Americans actually do, even though people who have, like, say, a religious commitment, they don't always do that. And there's a big gap, actually, between what people say they believe and what they, you know, probably sincerely believe and what they end up doing. So then the question for relativism, and I'm not sure this is an insurmountable obstacle, but do you go with what people believe or what they actually do as far as deciding what the rules are? Do you go with belief or practice? Some of the let me ask this question. So Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, we have this letter from Birmingham jail. Take Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks wouldn't sit in the back of the bus when the law said sit in the back of the bus, and she started a boycott of city buses and is regarded as kind of civil rights hero. Same thing with Martin Luther King, preached against segregation, and regarded as a great moral hero by many people, despite some of his failings as a human being. So the question is, what would relativism say about Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks if you assume that the majority of the time favored segregation? Yeah.
It would say that they were morally wrong.
Yeah, so Martin Luther King going against the status quo, bad guy, right? It's the only thing you can do wrong in cultural relativism is try to shake up the status quo. But there's a funny little catch. If you're successful in changing people's minds, your view goes from being wrong to being right. So while you're trying to change the society for the better, you're an immoral person. But if you succeed, then you go from being an immoral person to a moral person. Because remember, it's that cultural relativism just supports the status quo, whatever it is. Now, let me take a straw poll here. Who thinks that overall society has become more enlightened and a better place, say, in the last 150 years, that we've gone from we've become more enlightened as a society and have become more moral?
What does that mean?
We've become that overall people have become better. I just say from a moral point of view. Okay, just that. I get some hands there. Okay. So just like I'll take some examples. Like let's take the old race, class, and gender thing, right? So like in the 1850s, women couldn't vote. They were treated as the property of their husbands, largely. You had chattel slavery of African Americans, and then let's see what else. Let's take like those two things. So now we have full equality before the law. Maybe not perfect, and you still have some racist attitudes. But today, even you like tell a racist joke at a faculty meeting, you're getting drummed out. You're probably gonna get fired. Or at least you're going to get a big reprimand from your boss. Whereas before, it was seen as no big deal. People sit around the office, tell racial jokes, even when the person of that race walked by, and he's expected to just suck it up. Annual sexual harassment, we have laws against that now, whereas if you're sexually harassing a subordinate employee, you can get in big trouble, right? We had a president of the United States that got impeached over that, Bill Clinton. Sexually harassed Paul Jones, a subordinate employee, and he ended up losing his law license. He's the president of the United States. He harassed, sexually harassed a woman. He lost his law license, and he was impeached. I'd say that's a long way from like the women being treated as property. So in those two respects of race and gender, I think the United States, people in the United States have become more moral. And you can think of other things like the toleration of wife beating and domestic violence. Can anybody think of any other cases where maybe we've become more enlightened as a society? I stole all the good ones. Okay, the way children are treated in general, right? So you might say child labor might be one example of the sort of child welfare. What's that?
Child services now.
Child services. Maybe a mixed bag, but you might think overall, like if you get somebody who's beating the hell out of their kids, you know, you can go to jail and your kids get put with people who will take care of them. Animal cruelty laws. Some people would say even, you know, the increase of vegetarians or people that will only eat like free-range meat and eggs, where the animals treated well and not, treated like it's treated like it doesn't have sensation in a factory farm. So now, could you have? So this is what we call moral progress. So can you have moral progress according to cultural relativism?
Because the whole 15+1 was that one person, you know, like Martin Luther King, you know, everyone believes that, oh, no, slavery's great, and then he comes along with one person and he's like, actually, no, not so much.
So moral progress, and actually this is something in the text where it's kind of, I said you can't have moral progress in the sense of things getting better or worse, because better or worse requires some objective standard. But as you point out, you can get more agreement and call that progress. But that's not what most people think of as progress. So moral progress in, say, the ordinary sense, in the ordinary sense of a better society. Yeah. Not just a greater agreement. It's impossible. According to cultural relativism. So that's just to elaborate. So moral progress in the ordinary sense of a better society, not just, you know, greater agreement within a society, is impossible according to cultural relativism. Somebody want to explain why that is? Why can't you have a better society, or why can't society become more enlightened and more moral over time? As it seems that it has, if you're according to relativism. Yeah.
Well, there would have to be a standard by which you could measure that progress, and if it's relative, then that standard could continually change according to whoever the majority was, and you just never move toward that goal of how you would measure progress.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, wouldn't it say that the culture was right before the change? You know, that the culture could never be wrong.
Right, right. So you can't say things were worse when we had slavery, right? If the majority of people believed in slavery and slavery existed, then that wasn't any better or worse than today when the majority of people disapproved of slavery. It's just different. So you can't have better or worse. There's no better or worse. Different. Whereas most people would say you have racial, you know, equality, maybe. I'll just say racial equality before the law, and racists by and large shunned, versus maybe say in the
40s, 50s, 60s, where you had segregation, where the KKK had a lot of power, and then here you had slavery. And even your old Abe Lincoln says all the slaves should just go back to Africa, go back where they came from. And he wanted to have some ships to ship them back there, because he didn't think they fit in here. So you have the, I would say, the gradual changes in society for the better, where we recognize the underlying humanity in each person, and where each person is accorded individual rights and responsibility based on who they are as a person, their actions, and their character, and how they interact with their fellow human beings. We don't judge people on the basis of what color their skin is, or what shape their nose is, or whether their hair is curly or straight, you know, et cetera, the sort of surface characteristics, or where their ancestors came from. And I would say that's better, but relativism just says, well, that's just different. They believe in slavery, we believe in equality now. Equality is different from slavery, but it's no better and no worse. And that's kind of, again, a weird, it's a hard bullet to bite, I would say. I mean, think about, like, if you're, suppose you're like at a cocktail party with some friends, sipping your martinis. It's like, one of my professors used to always give me some damn like a cocktail party. I was thinking, the students will go to cocktail parties. But you're at some event, right? And you're hanging around, and you say, oh, yes, well, someone said, I was just reading a book on, like, the slave ships and slavery in the United States. It's kind of interesting. I think, man, we've come a long way. And you were to say, oh, well, you know, things were no better or no worse than as they are now. It's just, they were just different. And people look at you like you had two heads, and you'd probably be shunned. And if they say, you approved of slavery? And you say, well, slavery isn't right for us today, but it was right for them then. I think you'd be seen as a bad person. You'd be persona non grata. Yeah.
I think an easier way for me to try to relate to that is, I know my dad said, yeah, back when I was a kid, you know, we used to just throw stuff out the window, like trash. But nowadays, we'd be like, what? Literally, you know, you need a ticket for that.
Right.
Law. Mm-hmm. But back then, they just, whatever they had, threw it out of the car like while they're driving. So it's kind of like that. It was just different back then.
I remember we used to play this game when I was in grade school, date myself, but I don't know they still do this. There was a game called Smear to Queer. And like, you know, I was like, you know, when I was in, I don't know, second grade, I didn't know what queer meant. I just know that, like, that was the guy with the ball that you're supposed to, like, you know, slam into and knock him to the ground and, and, you know, try to get the ball from him. So, and it's like, you know, nobody thought anything of it. It was just, you know, it was just a game. And now it's like, I think about it, I'm like, you know, I kind of cringe a little bit. I think that's always a homophobic game, right? Yeah.
Growing up, there was that game in my elementary school, but we were told that queer was just strange. The older definition was queer.
So, yeah, so that's, so there, yeah, it's, right. Yeah, so sometimes you get these things that sort of people don't really know what they mean. But that was, you know, all the teachers knew that was what we're doing, and they didn't say, you know, you shouldn't, you know what queer means, and you know, you shouldn't. They play a game where you're like, you know, chasing the person because of their sexual orientation and so on. Whereas you might get something like that today. So just the moral progress thing is a problem. I think I hit all the high points about arguments against relativism. Was the one I missed, or maybe think of any other arguments against relativism? What's Martin Luther King have to say about relativism? Letter from Birmingham Jail.
Is it law that
isn't
moral?
It
is no law.
Yeah. So he says that you know, a law that, and then he says, well, how does he define morality?
Then he defines.
So he says any law that uplifts the human personality,
right,
is just, and anyone that degrades the human personality is unjust. And then where does this standard come from, according to King?
He's a minister, so wouldn't it be like an absolutist view, like from the Bible? That was that. moral code was from the Bible, because he was back to the minister.
Right, divine command theory.
Yeah.
So, and he actually says that, look, you have a choice. You can either believe in divine command theory, you can believe in cultural relativism. Cultural relativism gives you the Nazis. It gives you chattel slavery. Because unless you have some standard where you can say this is wrong, you're just left with each culture's rules, and there's no way to challenge them. You have no justification for challenging the Nazis or challenging chattel slavery in the 19th century. And so he says the choice is pretty clear that you need to choose divine command theory, because that's the only way we can say there's a set of divine rules and there's natural law, and he kind of conflates the two. This idea that you have these divine rules of human nature, and you also have divine commandments, and you also have these rules of human nature that go together and they transcend any cultural rule. And so even if you have the majority of society that says, say, gas the Jews, that still goes against God's law, and so it's wrong. And without God's law or some objective standard, you're just left with all these cultural rules, and some of them can be pretty heinous. There we go. All right. I called my PowerPoint here, and got just a couple of slides on talking about moral skepticism. So I did post the forums for this week. I got them up shortly before class, so those are up for you. I've got one on Gaiji's ring, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and then we're not going to get to David Hume until Wednesday. And there's a shutting down. What's going on with this computer? And I'm going to wait for it to reboot. So, comments, questions? Did I beat relativism to death? Is there any relativists left in the class? I'm sure about my little dongle, I could use my PowerPoint. There it goes. So let's talk about moral skepticism. So, somebody explain to me what is moral skepticism. What are the two other names for moral skepticism?
Anti-realism.
Excellent. Anti-realism.
Nihilism.
Nihilism or nihilism, either yeah. One. Right. So then what is the view of the moral skeptic? Morals don't exist. So when you say morals don't exist, what if I say, well, you know, I was in the store the other day and the guy in front of me said, oh, excuse me, you gave me the wrong change. I gave you a 10 out of 20. What was going on there? It seems like morals do exist. But he got too much money back, and he gave the extra money back because he wanted to be honest. So that seems like it's morals right there.
Honesty, not morals.
Maybe just
well, honesty is part of morality, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Right?
Well,
he's
doing
it's
about telling the truth, not about whether or not you feel bad.
Well, you know, I had my friend the other day tell me that he had this torrid affair with this woman, and like the sex was really great, but he felt guilty afterwards, especially when the kid was born. Right? So, I mean, there's morality right there. You see morality every day. Like people, somebody cuts in front of you on the freeway, you say, you jerk, you should turn on your signal. That's a moral judgment.
Right.
So then the question is, what does it mean to say there are no morals, or there's no such thing as morality, when it seems pretty clear that there is? Thoughts? Yes, sir.
I think what the thought is behind it is that ultimately there's no meaning to your moral choices, because there is no truth. There is nothing that is real. When we die, nobody will even know we're here. The earth will go away. It was all meaningless. So on that basis, there's no basis for the world. It's all illusion. It's what we want to do. There is no real standard. I think that's what you're talking about.
Okay, so I mean, some of that might be part of some people's beliefs about morality, but there's a lot of like metaphysics there about the fate of the earth and the meaning of life. I'm not sure that necessarily has to go wrong.
What I'm saying is that that's why he would say somebody like this would say there are no morals, is because there's no meaning really. Any meaning that we want to put on things is just an imagination that we have. In reality, there's not. So he would say, yeah, everybody has a moral code. But behind it all, it's all an illusion that people have. That's okay. Why there are no morals.
So there's no reality to morality.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember last time, I think, or the first day, I talked about moral skeptics being sort of like moral atheists. So you think about an atheist doesn't say there's no such thing as religion, right? Because obviously people are going to church and they're praying and they're appealing to God and they have all these beliefs about God and it affects their behavior. He's just saying that there's nothing behind it, that there's no God. There's no metaphysical being that these people are interacting with. It's all an illusion. And so the moral skeptic will say a similar sort of thing. Got my PowerPoint here. And we're gonna start right. There we go. Gaiju's ring. Somebody dim the lights in front here so you can see this a little better. Just like this one right here. Just like turn it down all the way. That's good. These LCDs are a little washed out. So, Gaiju's ring. So, I gave you a section from Plato's Republic, one of the most famous philosophical works of all time. And so in the Republic, Plato has a discussion of the nature of justice. And you have Socrates, the main character of the dialogue, the father of philosophy. And Socrates, who's always the main character in Plato's dialogues, Plato is Socrates' student. So you have Plato writing these dialogues where his master, Socrates, always is the main character. And I think generally speaking represents Plato's point of view. So you have Socrates arguing with his friend Glaucon about the nature of justice. And so Glaucon is sort of playing devil's advocate. And now, what Glaucon's doing is he's saying, okay, well, Socrates, here's what people say. People say that justice is a bunch of nonsense, and that actually injustice is better than justice. And so he gives this sort of devil's advocate view so Socrates can refute it. So, and this is what you get in Plato, where somebody takes up like the skeptical side and somebody else, you know, usually Socrates will be taking up the other side, the side that Plato wants to prove, and they have this back and forth. Philosophy emerges from two minds adversarially going at each other. And so so to illustrate his point, Glaucon tells the story of a lowly shepherd who finds a magical ring. And the ring gives him the power of invisibility. And so what Gaiju does, the art needs to kind of sex up the presentation here. So what Gaiju does is he uses this ring to seduce the queen and assassinate the king. So, if you look at what he did, first of all, how did he find this ring? Well, there was like a big earthquake, and it opened up this grave, and he's like, oh, a grave, I wonder if there's anything valuable in there. So, first of all, he's a grave robber. He goes in there, steals this ring, and he's kind of fidgeting with it on his finger, and then he like turns it, and all of a sudden, his friends are reacting like he's not there, like he's talking to them, they're not listening to him, and he's like going like this in front of their face, and they don't see him. He's like, ooh, I'm invisible. What can I do with this? And so what does he do? Well, he gets the things that he goes out to the things people want. sex, money, power. And so he uses this to make himself king, to seduce the very beautiful queen in the process, as a means to an end, and also probably an end in itself. So you can see, here's a Gyges. Look at this one. He's slinking the shadows off the side here someplace. And here's another one. Oh, you can see him over there, slinking around. There's the king and the queen. So here's... And here's a more kind of Rubenesque queen here. So what he says is that most people, well, not most people, all people want to be unjust. What do you want to do? If you see something, you want to take it. If somebody makes you angry, you want to hit him in the face. If you see an attractive member of the opposite sex, you know, you want to get with them. If they say no, you're not going to care. Right? And so what do you want to go? You want to be like the Vikings, going around raping, pillaging, and taking what you want, whether it's yours or not. And he says, the only reason people act justly is that they fear punishment. You think, oh no, if I take that thing that's not mine, like I'm like, oh, you know, I want to get one, I like those new iPads, I can't afford them right now. If you like steal one and you're caught, you're going to go to jail. And you're going to probably be drummed out of college, and it's going to be really bad. And so what people do is they respect the law, they act as good, upstanding citizens, and most importantly, they praise justice and goodness to their friends. On the other hand, if they're say, in one of the restrooms here at LCC, and they see in those sort of cubby holes where people put their books, they see, like, say, a calculus book, or one of those genetics books or something, and it's like, you know, oh, that's one of those books that are worth like $100 or $200 used. They might just sort of look around, peek out the bathroom, stuff it in their duffel bag, and run out real quick, right? And then they'll go sell it on eBay or Amazon or something like that, and they'll have $100. And so Glaucon says that people will behave unjustly when they can get away with it. So punishment depends on detection. And he says, well, what about the gods? Well, he says, you read all the stories about the gods, and they're always being bought up by sacrifices, and you know, people butter them up with praise, and they serve the gods. As long as you serve the gods, they don't really care what you do if you're going around committing antisocial acts. The only thing they care about is they get their animal sacrifices, and that you pay off the people's temple, and that you do right by the gods, and you can do what you want. And so he says, well, what should you do then? Well, injustice is always going to be better when you can get away with it. So the completely rational man will seek to be unjust where possible, just when necessary. So he'll be, if you're going to be rational now, not just like go on your feelings, or you're going to do what's in your best interest. If you're going to be completely rational, what you should do is be just, be unjust where it's possible, i.e. where you can get away with it, and then be just when necessary, when people are looking, right? So you don't want to be like stealing when people are looking, otherwise you're going to go to jail. You don't want to... I was at this visual effects boot camp where I was like a TA, and we're, you know, teaching people how to use the visual effects that they do in movies. And as we're going on, somebody said, "Oh, have you seen the new Transformers movie?" And one of the participants said, "Oh yeah, I downloaded a screener. I didn't think it was very good, so I've already seen it." And he was initially going out to the IMAX theater. And so one of the instructors there like looked at him with this like horrified expression and says, "Why would you do that?" And then suddenly he realized, "Oh wait a minute! Like I'm like doing an illegal download, and this like that movies and visual effects like in Transformers is the bread and butter of the people who are putting on this conference." And he realized it was a major faux pas. So if he was going to be rational, what he would say was like, "I better not say that I downloaded the screener," and he would just say, "Oh, it doesn't really interest me." He would lie, right? Why should he lie? To avoid having a bad reputation. The only reason you should be just is to have a good reputation.
you should avoid being caught being unjust to have a bad reputation. And so justice is only instrumentally good. It gives you a good reputation, and it keeps you out of jail. And so you should only be just, though, or you should only avoid injustice when there's a really high chance of getting caught and there are severe consequences. So in some cases, there's a really good chance of getting caught, but the consequences might be kind of low, right? Like speeding, right? So okay, so you're speeding down the I-5. It's, you know, you don't like driving so slow. You're driving safely. You might get a ticket, and maybe it's about, like, you know, $100 or something like that. If you have $100, no big deal. Don't get another ticket in the next year, no big deal. I don't know, maybe more. But if you got some money, $100, $200, for the convenience of driving at 75, 80 miles an hour, you might say, decent trade-off, right? Maybe keep your eyes peeled, look in the rearview mirror, watch the side of the road, and you're calling it. On the other hand, there might be some cases where there are severe consequences, there's almost no chance of getting caught. And there, maybe you might want to risk it. So, an example. Anybody know who this is? This is a representative, Anthony Weiner, Congressman Weiner. And this is Congressman Weiner's Weiner. Which he accidentally, he meant to send this to a young lady, and accidentally sent this to all of his Twitter followers. So the lesson here, now what some people would say, the moralists would say, the lesson here is don't send pictures of your wiener, especially if your name is wiener, and you don't want to be the butt of jokes for the rest of your life. Don't do that. But Glaucon would say, go ahead and do it, just don't get caught. And so this will not end well, right? So, so why is this a bad idea? Well, it's because this guy's like a kung fu expert with all the weapons and stuff. But if he was like some kind of dweeby accountant guy who, like, it was, you know, the reason the wife's stepping out of him is because he's not taking care of business in the bedroom, maybe it's a good idea, right? If you could, like, beat him up. But it's like some skinny guy. And so you have various degrees of punishment, right? You get a ticket, you might end up in jail, or you can face a death penalty and do something really bad. And so what Glaucon says is you want to avoid, you don't want to not do these things that are good for you but bad for other people. What you want to do is avoid getting caught. So hypocrisy. There's our Treasury Secretary Tax Chief, Tim Geithner, also head of the IRS. And so so Glaucon's conclusion, again, he says, it's best to seem just, but to be secretly unjust. And that actually being just is a kind of a necessary goal. So you don't want to be just when you don't have to be. The reason you're just is so people think you're a good guy. But when nobody's looking, what you should do is go around stabbing people in the back, stealing stuff, doing what you want, basically. And I think that's... so what do you think about this? Maybe I should wait till next time. Do I have one more? Oh, okay. Sorry,
let me go back here.
Why just let this sit, and let's knock off a little early, so we're going to pick up here next time. I want a good argument about why I should be just when I can get away with being unjust.